this is really talking about work we've been doing in Wales for about the last 6 or 7 years, because we had some specific funding to set up a public health improvement research network. And really, what our goals were in setting up that network are to increase research relevance and making some of the big studies we wanted to do more feasible to conduct, and also then have more rapid and clear impact on policy and practice. And we've done that by trying to sort of fairly formally develop a knowledge exchange approach. So a lot of you might have heard of knowledge translation, you know, translation of research into practice. We don't just do that as a one-way thing. We deliberately set things up as a knowledge in a knowledge exchange framework type way, which I'll talk about. So in thinking about that, and I know this is a bit kind of stereotypical and rose-tinted, but if we think about a stereotypical professorial-led research team, such as you have in the John Radcliffe here, you will have a clinical team led by a consultant who is probably also a professor. So the clinicians and the clinical researchers are co-located, and they're usually the same people, and they're there with the patients and identifying every day the clinical questions to which they don't know the answer. And so identifying research questions, then generating the evidence, and that then immediately impacting on their practice is just integral to what they do, and it's integral to training. So everyone coming up from having the first qualified as a medical student, and increasingly in medical students' training, the whole kind of evidence generation, critical appraisal skills, getting involved in research studies is just part of clinical training and part of the clinical team. Therefore you have within that, as I say, maybe rose-tinted stereotypical perception of what goes on there, you do have a virtuous cycle of knowledge exchange occurring in that context. So you have the patient who don't quite know what to do, that's the evidence gap, the research question being identified. You can then do the research to generate the evidence in that context, maybe often as leading or being part of a multi-centre trial. You're still doing it there with your patients and with your fellow clinicians and researchers there. That can then be synthesised and then quite rapidly translated into policy and practice. And certainly once you've done the study on your ward, you might immediately change your practice, you know, before the paper's been published or anything else, because you've been taking part of the study, you know the results, and so therefore you know how you're going to take your practice forward. And then there's this constant feedback then of once you've got a new, you know, there'll always be new research questions being identified. So this is knowledge exchange, and that kind of context, that setting for knowledge exchange is perfect. If we look at what we have, I mean, my area is public health, but I think for public health you could read any kind of sort of social policy sector, I think. You by and large have a separation of the research community from the policy and practice community. We have our focus on RAE, now REF. We have our ivory tower perspective. We have our, you know, four-star publications. We have getting our PhD thesis finished, getting our postdoc, whatever it is. So of all the pressures of the kind of university setting, of the things that primarily drive us, you know, if we're being rational beings within that setting. And then on the other hand, you have the NHS, or you have the social care sector, or whatever it might, or the education sector, whatever you. Different drivers, different agendas, different pressures upon them. Very separate. So that builds up, that leads to the inevitable situation that you tend to have quite weak intervention research. Intervention research is not something that's been privileged in the past by research assessment exercises, even by REF now, still not the case, but a little bit more now with the kind of impact part of REF. Policy and practice is influenced by many, many factors, as we all know, and evidence is pretty low on that list still, unfortunately. And partly that's because access, use, and impact of research evidence is very limited. And the thing that I find most concerning is actually there's quite a culture in many parts of major kind of policy and practice organisations in all aspects of social care, I think, that evaluation is actually seen as threatening. So rather than, whereas on the clinical side, evaluation is seen as part of good practice, constantly improving practice by taking part in research and questioning what you're doing, collecting data to improve what you're doing.
there's so many cases where a practitioner who's developed a new intervention and got the support of their local organisation to back it actually sees the whole idea of getting an external person to come in and evaluate it as being deeply threatening, and therefore that's a massive barrier to them engaging in an evidence-based culture, and certainly a major barrier to them engaging in an honest scientific evaluation. And there tends to have been this thing where lots and lots of things funded by lottery funding or other project-type funding are always evaluated, but evaluated very much in inverted commas and with kind of like a cap on the budget that can be spent on evaluation, such that it can never be done very well, and generally speaking isn't actually even done by an evaluation specialist. So you have this real problem, and a lot of the problems all come down to the separation of the two communities. So if we see, on the one hand, we have our university community, which is coloured red because we're quite slow at doing anything. We do it well, but we do it quite slow. And then you've got the action out there on the front line where there's quite a lot of innovation, but there's very much local focus and not a lot of engagement in the kind of the general evidence base. We can't just carry on just having these communities separate. We need to do what we can to promote this virtuous cycle of knowledge exchange. I still think there is a place for having a knowledge translation function, knowledge broker function, having sort of specific kind of even a whole kind of professional groupings, but certainly lots of kind of resources and what have you to promote the dissemination of evidence to policy and practice organisations and professionals. But really, I think there's a lot of evidence a lot of the evidence from Canada, where they've been very at the vanguard of this, have shown that working together, co-producing knowledge is actually a really major part of effective knowledge translation practice. And this knowledge exchange cycle is all about co-producing new knowledge and then making sure that the targets of that knowledge, so the consumers of knowledge, the policymakers, practitioners, actually are bought into it, they have some ownership of it, and therefore it's much more likely to be taken up. And because they're involved in doing it, it's also much more relevant to them. So that's the kind of model that we've tried to promote in FERN, the Public Health Improvement Research Network. I'll rattle through these slides. This is the kind of just sort of thinking back to what we did in 2006, where we identified that whilst lots and lots of money was being spent to increase the volume and quality of evaluation research in the NHS, that was all targeted on tackling these barriers about how you recruit patients into trials and how you streamline ethics and regulation processes and that kind of thing, and having research nurses located in hospitals. We said, because in Wales we had an ability to bid to the same pot of money that was being pumped into improving the NHS research infrastructure, whereas in England it was just all spent on primary and particularly hospital-based research. We sort of said, well, actually, the key barriers in public health intervention research are these. It's the scale, expense, complexity of interventions, the unexploited potential for natural experiments, so the fact that so much innovation was going on in policy and practice and new policies were being launched but just not being evaluated properly, so the opportunity to find out what did and didn't work wasn't being taken. And the fact that there are all these different kind of communities, different disciplines, different sectors, university, non-academics, and also the fact that so much of the key levers to improve public health are in the social sector outside the NHS. So based on that kind of assessment of what the barriers are and these kind of weaknesses, the limited sort of dialogue and the fact that opportunities to rigorously evaluate innovations and services were not being taken, and that if evaluations were done of new policies and projects, they tended to be just with a very much a local kind of focus, low budget, poor quality, not really generalisable, not really contributing to the evidence base. We said, if you give us the money to set up a public health improvement research network, we can tackle some of those key barriers to good evidence generation and relevance of that evidence in public health. So we said we will aim to increase the quantity and quality of public health improvement research in Wales that is relevant to policy and practice. And a key objective of doing that was breaking down the divide between academic research and the little amount of academic intervention research that was going on within universities, and local evaluation activity. So there's a number of different ways we try to do that. We try to sort of make sure that we're working through, in partnership, a continuous process of identifying new research priorities, bringing together teams that have academics, policymakers, and practitioners in those teams who then take forward priority research projects, and continually sort of having spaces where we can have dialogue about new evidence, new policy developments, and any local innovation that we perhaps should be aware of that might be a good basis for a new research project. We also have a number of different kind of secondary kind of things we do, so exchanging new methodological approaches, identifying big innovations in policy and practice at an early stage so we can plan together and maximise the opportunity of doing a really good quality natural experiment or policy trial, as I'll show you, and work together to develop high quality research project proposals and execute them as funded studies. So a few specific things that we do, and the main thing I just want to talk about briefly, because it was what I mentioned before, is these RDGs, Research Development Groups. So research development groups, if we identify a new topic for research, and this won't be a broad topic, it will usually be quite a specific research question, we then say, well, let's set up a research development group, and that will be a small group of no more than 10, usually sort of 6, 7, 8 people, with a lead, with someone to kind of help facilitate it. And then each of those teams would always include at least one non-academic partner. So sometimes we're approached by a local practitioner who's just developed something that just you know, they've been doing on their own. They think it's quite exciting and they say, we'd like to work with you to take it forward into a developmental feasibility phase for further research. Or it might be that we're approached by the head of Public Health Wales saying there's this really big new kind of programme we're bringing in and we want to work with you to evaluate it. So in our research development groups, right from the beginning, in framing the specific research question, there will be non-academics involved. And then we sort of project manage those groups with a timetable to then take them forward into protocol development or funding application development, whatever is usually it's a funding application, but sometimes it's actually we're working with the Welsh Government or with the National Public Health Service to work on just an evaluation protocol for something they're doing anyway. And it's been really successful. We've had lots of these RDGs set up now over sort of six years of practice, and we've got a very high success rate with our research funding applications, and we've brought in quite a lot of research funding. So this kind of model of co-production does seem to have been very successful. One of the things we do, we don't have lots of sort of meaningless meetings. We do largely just facilitate these small research development groups. But obviously one of the things you've got to do is how do we get these research development groups together? And that's done by actually just sort of maximising dialogue, really, and developing these informal networks we talked about before. But we do run these quarterly seminars. And I just wanted to give an example. We did a seminar, Health Challenge Wales seminar. We had one which was about alcohol issues. And we had about 80 people there. There were the key policy people from Welsh Government. There were quite a few people from the National Public Health Service and the local health boards. There was a lot of people came from the police and some other third sector organisations. And there were also quite a few researchers. And whilst in that session we presented some of the latest evidence and what is and isn't effective, actually the focus of those seminars is always to identify new research questions, so new innovations or new policy sort of developments on coming through that might be really good research studies coming online. And in the one we did on alcohol, there were two things that came up. One was a licensed premises intervention to reduce alcohol misuse and violent injury, and that's essentially where with police support, an auditor goes into all the pubs and clubs in town and sort of does a check through a specific audit about what the pub or club is doing to prevent inappropriate serving of alcohol, and also to modify the environment and all sorts of aspects of the premises in relation to minimising the extent to which violence will occur in relation to people being excessively drunk. We put that together to the MRC, and we had a research platform funding call application that was successful to do a feasibility trial. We had another one which was with the police to develop this to bring over a promising program that engaged parents in with curriculum-based alcohol education, and we took that forward with the police as a fairly small-scale developmental study, really. And then both of those have now led on to larger-scale studies. So the top one is now a major trial funded by the NIHR Public Health Research Programme. So we've changed the intervention quite a bit. It's now implemented by environmental health officers so that when they routinely visit pubs and clubs, as they have to do for all sorts of statutory reasons, they now include this audit in what they do. And we're doing a big cluster randomised trial across many areas of Wales, with lots of pubs and clubs being randomised to that. And then the second one is now a larger scale feasibility trial, again funded by the Public Health Research Programme. So just an example of how by having one meeting we made enough kind of connections, had enough ideas coming up that we could take them forward in research development groups into fundable and funded studies. So lessons from what we've done in that kind of vein, some sort of do's and don'ts. I mean, one thing, talking to a policy kind of audience, is don't evaluate everything. And this is one of the problems of project funding. Everything is evaluated badly, so there's no real learning emerging from that. If you evaluate something, evaluate it well. So identify the things that really are worth evaluating and make sure you evaluate them well. Don't sort of create unnecessary activity. Don't have lots of meetings and more meetings, just sort of talking about how, yes, we must work together in this space and this is an important policy issue and blah, blah, blah. But actually manage it so it's all about facilitating action-oriented activities like the research development groups, which do take things forward. And by working together and co-producing knowledge, that's where the real kind of collaboration occurs and where the real kind of partnership develops and the increased understanding between the academics and the policy community develops. Don't just stay in your own tent, don't just sit there complaining about bloody policymakers who don't take any notice of my evidence that I've just published in this very obscure journal that no one can access. Get out there and talk to people, and then it will improve the quality and relevance of your research, and it will certainly improve its impact. So do sort of relax within the constraints of developing a university career. Do relax your kind of academic purity. But also, again, speaking to practitioners in particular, don't think evaluation is threatening your pet project. See evaluation as improving your pet project. Or if your pet project is actually a waste of time, it's probably quite nice to find out, really, rather than wasting half your career on something that's just a waste of time or potentially even causing harm. So see evaluation as a positive thing rather than a threatening thing. And I think increasingly something that's coming up more and more as the quality of data linkage and the ability for us to do lots of really important analyses using linked data from a range of social, health, educational data sets. I think there's going to be more and more power for us to do really important kind of policy development, particularly policy evaluation studies, using good quality data sets that are increasingly available. So I think that's an area of rapid development. In terms of do's, I think do focus on some of these processes. So don't just think about it would be nice to sort of speak to policymakers a bit more, but think about what are the processes you can put in place to make it happen. And I've mentioned some of the ones we've thought of. There were some discussions earlier about maybe making sure that PhD students have some contact with a professional, whether it be a policymaker or a practitioner working in their area, because you will get lots of useful ideas and feedback into what you're doing. So what processes can you build into your training or into your project development process or your project execution process that will increase the engagement with the research user community? Do focus on research questions, I think, rather than just general areas of interest. You know, the quicker you get to research question, the quicker you've got something you can work on together, and the quicker you can move through debates about what's the right methodology, because once you've got the question, it's usually fairly clear what the right methodology is. Do focus on co-production, do think about the full cycle of knowledge exchange, and do recognise that by doing that, you are not only doing a good project, hopefully, but you're also building up long-term capacity to facilitate that, and certainly something we feel we're getting towards now in Cardiff is because we've got quite a lot of people working in this area. We do feel we're beginning to sort of be able to claim that we've got kind of like a specialist community trials unit as a collaboration between my group, Decipher, and the South East Wales Trials Unit. And that's developing into a very sort of important grouping to be able to facilitate these kinds of studies. And then finally, bridging roles. I mean, it's interesting that, again, Canada has done a lot of work in how you increase the sort of the linkage between policy and practice. And they've invested a lot in spanners. And I had to sort of say to them, what do you mean by spanner? So they talk about people spanning the academic and policy community. And I said, what do you mean, a wrench? Or I said, sometimes we use spanner in a fairly pejorative way. So bridging roles, or people who span the two communities. And certainly in Decipher, we have quite a few people who have joint roles. So we have two people now who are jointly employed by the university and by the one PCT in England and by the National Public Health Service in Wales. And that's really valuable. So the kind of work we've done there, and some of these preceded the start of Fern Decipher, but the kind of work we've done has facilitated quite a number, and this is an exhaustive list. We've already looked at two alcohol ones, which aren't listed here, of fairly large-scale trials we have done, and there are other studies we've done that have been non-randomised studies, where we have worked in some shape or form with policy and practitioners as partners in conducting studies that have produced, hopefully, unbiased estimates of effect, but have also produced lots of sort of other useful knowledge in terms of maximising translation into policy and practice. This last one is one that's currently ongoing, where we have funding from the MRC for all the research costs of conducting this trial of the Strengthening Families programme, but all the programme funding is coming from the Welsh Government. And so we were able to sort of, because we had been working with them over an extended period, we were able to engineer that opportunity to sort of say, don't just launch Strengthening Families in Wales without evaluating it properly. If you can just hold on a little bit, we might be able to get £2 million, as it turned out, from the Medical Research Council to do a really large-scale randomised trial of the programme. The Fruit Touch Shop Initiative, the Free Breakfast Initiative, and then the study I'll talk to you a little bit, but obviously very briefly now, are studies where they have been interventions that have been planned by government. We have persuaded them to implement them in a randomised way rather than just rolling them out in the usual kind of ad hoc way. So we have done randomised trials nested within policy rollout. So this is the name of the centre, Developing and Evaluating Complex Interventions for Public Health Improvement. So good way of getting a good acronym. And I will just briefly, for 5 minutes, just say a little bit about a recent trial we've done, which, as I say, isn't such a social care-based trial as some of the other ones we have done, or a school-based trial, but is quite interesting from a methodological point of view, I think. So exercise referral schemes. There's been a lot of these schemes. They've been rapidly developing over the last few years, and this is where, in primary care, you'll be identified as someone who could benefit from doing more physical activity, and you'll be then referred to a local leisure centre or similar to have a specialist to assist you in doing more physical activity. NICE did a review, and it was great when they concluded this, but I don't think they've done this again, because the evidence base was ambiguous. They said practitioners, policymakers, and commissioners should only endorse exercise referral schemes to promote physical activity that are part of a properly designed and controlled research study to determine effectiveness. So this was NICE saying the evidence doesn't say these aren't worth doing, but the evidence doesn't say these are worth doing. So if you do take them forward as part of a well conducted evaluation. So that was great for us, because we had already been speaking with Welsh Government about what they were going to do about exercise referral in Wales. So they had a further reason to push them towards commissioning a high-quality evaluation of the scheme they were doing. In Wales, prior to 2007, there were about 20 different exercise referral schemes. Each local area in Wales, and they're quite small, had a different scheme. They all thought they were the best. They all had lots of little anecdotal evidence to say theirs was the best, but actually they were all different, so they couldn't all be the best. So the Welsh Assembly Government said, we're either going to stop funding these, or we want to sort of do a good evaluation of a harmonised national scheme to find out whether it's worth carrying on with or not. And that's what happened. So they set up a national exercise referral scheme that in its first 3 years was only available to people if they were willing to take part in the randomised trial. So it was only available to people who were willing to be randomised. So it's fantastic they did that. We can't take the credit for it, but obviously it came out, that came about to some extent due to our partnership that we developed over the years, and also the support of the NICE guidance. There's two papers from a group in Cambridge and a group in UCL who both tried to do a trial of exercise referral and both failed because they didn't have the networks and the long-term relationships, so they couldn't persuade the local areas that they were working with to take it forward in a randomised way. So they criticised the NICE guide, saying there's no way you'll ever do a randomised trial here. Well, we did one. I heard some talk earlier about the importance in evaluation of developing a logic model and really focusing on evaluating the logic model. So I know you can't read this, but this is where you might think an exercise referral scheme is quite simple, but it's actually got quite a complex logic model, because it has quite a few different components in the intervention, which include goal setting, motivational interviewing, a full 16-week programme supervised by a qualified exercise professional at level 3, some one-to-one exercise sessions, but also a focus on group classes to try and promote sort of groups doing exercise together and maintain that, so say the maintenance thing beyond the initial scheme, and then discounted access to the scheme. So there's quite a few components that theoretically for good reasons are there, and then each of which are aimed to set off certain kind of intermediate outcomes leading to long-term independent adherence to exercise. So we set up a randomised trial across 12 local health boards where patients referred to the scheme and eligible for the scheme were then randomised to either be access the scheme or to be waitlisted for 12 months. So it was a waitlist randomisation rather than pure randomisation. And we wanted to evaluate not just in terms of identifying does it work, but borrowing from Porson and Tilley, we wanted to understand why it may be effective for some and not for others, for whom and under what circumstances, and also to do a cost effectiveness evaluation as well. So we had 12-month outcomes. The primary outcome was physical activity. Secondary outcome was anxiety and depression. I say that I've got the references at the end for the papers that have come out. So we got a 83% of the sample gave us a measure of physical activity at 12-month follow-up. 68% gave us the 7-day physical activity recall. For those of whom didn't complete that, because that was quite a long postal written questionnaire, we also did telephone interviews to get alternative measures of physical activity so we could get a measure of physical activity for 83% of them. There was no great response bias across the two groups. Of those allocated to the interventions, 43% in the intervention arm completed the 16-week programme. Another 40% completed part of the programme, and 15% didn't actually attend the programme at all. But they were all included in, because it was analysed as intention to treat. So I just have to whiz through a couple of the slides now. So I say it was a primary intention to treat analysis, and there were various planned subgroup analyses. And we found overall that there was an increase in physical activity, which was statistically significant in those referred for coronary heart disease risk factors, but was not very present for those referred for mental health reasons. There was a statistically significant impact on depression, so depression scores were reduced in the intervention group across both groups and across the whole group. Then anxiety was significantly reduced amongst those referred to for mental health reasons, but was not so strong in those with CHD risk factors. So for those referred for mental health reasons, they had good outcomes in terms of depression and anxiety, but there wasn't really any great evidence that had been mediated through increasing physical activity. And that's an interesting finding that's been found by quite a few studies. We can talk about that in questions if you like. But for those referred for CHD risk factors, there was good impacts on physical activity and some mental health effects as well. The reason why it's methodologically interesting, which I can't say too much about because I've sort of waffled on so much, is that we also were able to do quite a lot of planned subgroup analyses, and also we had quite a lot of process evaluation nested in, which enabled us to answer lots of questions over and above just, did it work? So for example, we could, so we did some subgroup effects. So we looked at the effects by deprivation, so it's the Welsh index of multiple deprivation. There was no significant variation by that or by age. Mental health effects were slightly better in women. For those who completed the programme, the 16-week programme, there were really strong effects in all three areas. So it showed, you know, as you might expect, that those who complied with the programme really benefited much more than those who dropped out, so not surprising. And then with the cost-effectiveness analysis showed that it was a very cost-effective scheme. We did do quite a bit of process evaluation, which I can't do justice to in the amount of time I have left. Basically, this was a PhD by one of my colleagues, Graham Moore. We've already got three papers published from the process evaluation here. So there were many different sort of sources of data. So interviewing the Welsh government representatives and the local coordinators of the scheme. Also assessing the interactions between the exercise professionals and the patients to assess the extent to which they did the motivational interviewing and the goal setting appropriately, and also doing quite a few interviews with patients and professionals to find out a little bit more about their experience of the scheme. And as I say, I can't talk about this too much because of time, but actually there were some really interesting findings from this. Let's look at this slide. So we did find that some of the key, if you remember the logic model, some components of the scheme were offered fairly consistently, fairly well across all sites. So the basic kind of components of doing the baseline health check, having the one-to-one with the level three qualified professional, having group exercise classes offered for a period of time and having the discounted access, that was fairly standard across all areas. Some of the more important parts of the scheme in terms of the logic model were in some cases hardly present at all. So motivational interviewing, which has got quite a strong evidence base about it, it was very important to Welsh Government to include that in the scheme. But the fidelity of implementation of that, of the sessions we monitored, only 8% of them met the standards of proper motivational interviewing. Goal setting, only 1 in 3 of the recorded goals that were set were actually goals that were really proper goals, in other words, being measurable goals with a time-bound element. A lot of them were just very vague, like lose weight or get fitter, so they're not really goals at all. A lot of the four-week follow-up that should have been there, both at 4 weeks and after the scheme, was implemented very, very patchily. So because we had this data, we've been able to sort of link that to the outcome data to see how important some of these things were, which I haven't got time to talk about. But also, there is a paper we're working on now which will be the lead author, will be the policy lead for this scheme since after the trial. And they have specifically built into how they have taken the scheme forward a lot of these elements that we found from the process evaluation as being of suboptimal quality in the implementation of the scheme in the trial. So the trial did find that the scheme was effective, even though it was conducted at an early stage and when a lot of the implementation was poor, but we've identified which components of the intervention are key, and that has led directly into kind of policy modification beyond. So it's a nice example of, by having that relationship with the key kind of people commissioning this in Welsh Government, they were willing to commission it as a randomised trial nested within policy rollout, and they've immediately used the results of the trial to continue the scheme but also to improve it. So as I say, we feel we've answered questions not just does this work, you know, but who does it work for, why does it work, what are the areas which can be improved, and that has led into to policy development as well. So I better finish there because I've gone for 50 minutes, so I'm at the point of taking any of your questions, I think, please.